there's some people.
Great, so my name is Wendy Call, and welcome. And I think this is a short enough list of people, we don't have to have any ground rules. And it's only been 5 days, so how much could you possibly do, right? So it's been really exciting to be one of the teaching staff this week, and I'm really looking forward to next week, too, with my co-teachers and housemates here, Trish and Kathleen, and Judy is not here. No? Okay, so we have 9 people who are going to present their work tonight, visual, literary, maybe a combination, and first up is Liz for artist, it says.
Oh, yes.
Oh.
Thank you.
I'm honored to be number one because it'll be the only time in my life I'm number one with my art. And I recall back in kindergarten doing a watercolor. And that inspired me so when I came to Trisha's class, I decided I should do my second work of art since kindergarten. Now, this could be somewhat of a Rorschach test to determine what it is, but the creative part is I need to do something a little bit different so there'd be some novelty to it. So I'd like you to admire the fine border and then, unable to afford a frame, I painted a frame. Now,
very nice.
In all seriousness, I'd like to say, if you ever make cards with photographs, and that's an art idea, you can tear photographs like this and put it on a card, and it makes it a much more impressive effect than just putting your photo on the card. So that's my little artistic hint. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz. I was wondering if Liz was going to come clean about the fact that she is actually a visual artist, if not a watercolorist. A professional photographer. So next up we have a Holden regular, Casey Schultz, and we're going to read what work of literary art.
Yes. So this isn't actually something I wrote this week, but I wrote it recently. So it's about the Mother's Day hike that my family took down Railroad Creek Trail in May. So there was lots of snow still. It started out as a whim, one of those casual remarks that no one takes seriously until someone decides it's a good idea. Let's do a Mother's Day hike to the lake. But as soon as my alarm went off at 5:40 a.m., the morning after prom, I knew this Mother's Day hike down Lower Railroad Creek Trail was a bad idea. But groupthink won out over my personal misgivings, and we set off, naively optimistic about our first hike of the year. When we reached the trail, we stepped onto the frozen snow, grateful for the icy crust on top, and figuring we would soon be out of the snow and free to blaze down the trail. But after 2 hours, there was no end in sight to the gradually softening snow, and Mom's knees and ankles were beginning to betray her. At this point, it was too late to turn around, and even though we didn't know how much longer the snow would last, at least if we kept going, we had a chance of leaving the snow behind. Finally, after 4 hours of slogging, we collapsed onto a rock outcropping in the sun and wrung out our socks as Dad gave Mom a back massage to alleviate her pain. We ate a granola bar, and the taste of victory began to creep back into our mouths. But then we saw the transport rumble down the small ribbon of the road opposite us, and Dad's radio crackled. Transport entering the narrows at Elephant Trap. Elephant Trap. The victory sunk in our stomachs, dissolved with the bar in our stomach acid. Elephant Trap was only at 6 Mile. We hadn't even gone 5 miles yet. This trail was 13.5 miles long, and if we kept up our current pace, we would be lucky to reach the lake by dark. Then again, with the rate at which Mom's injuries were developing, we would be lucky to reach the lake at all. With a groan, we shoved our feet back into our soggy socks and boots, slung our packs over our shoulders, with the exception of Mom, who had given her pack to Dad, and hit the trail again. New energy coursed through us when we realized that we had crossed over from winter to spring, and our pace tripled. now that we no longer had to kick out footholds in the slanted slush or worry about post-holing onto a rock and breaking an ankle. The sun shone through the trees, birds chirped happily above our heads, the smell of new growth wafted through the air, and even when Mom managed to mangle her ski pole in a creek crossing, our mood was undiminished. We were already in the burn area. We were going to make it. Soon we could rest and soak our aching feet in the cool waters of Lake Chelan. We came to a fallen tree and quickly ducked under it, refusing to let anything stand in our way. But then we came to another tree, and another, and now the burn area was looking less and less like a leisurely walk through the open forest, and more like a grueling death march of pushing through thickets of dead branches, scrambling over pickup stick-like arrangements of fallen trees, and forgetting about those small stubs on the logs where branches used to be until my legs slammed into them. Needless to say, when we finally escaped the burn area, twigs stuck out from my backpack and my hair, and I had collected a few new bruises. But the trees no longer blocked our path, and my feet tripped down the trail, picking up speed as we began our descent. And then I heard a short cry and a thud from behind me. I turned, too exhausted to be concerned, to see my mother sprawled on the ground next to the root she had tripped over. I saw my despair reflected in the faces of Corey and Dad, and I began to calculate how far I thought Dad and I could carry her without injuring ourselves. But then Mom slowly got to her feet and brushed herself off, her face grim. Let's keep going. So we did. We finally dragged ourselves onto the road and saw Steph and Chuck standing on the bridge, clapping and cheering. We managed a half smile and then shuffled onto the bus, which rumbled up the road an hour later than scheduled. We glanced at each other like soldiers after a war. Well, Dad said, passing around a bag of pulverized chocolate chip cookies. Happy Mother's Day.
Excellent story that makes me very glad that I'm from west of the Cascades, where things like that don't happen.
Oh, yeah. Surprise.
We have some stories for you.
Come back in May. Come back in May.
So, next up we have, you're showing artistic work, literary work, Lorna?
Artistic.
So, Lorna has perfect attendance this week in both the writing class and the visual art class.
You made many points.
We did. I've been gathering them all week. I came to Holden to see the mountains, the streams, the beautiful scenery, and I painted laundry. Last year I came up, 2 years ago I came up and I painted brooms. So you can see that my focus is probably not where it should be. But I don't paint anywhere except at Holden, so this is pretty exciting. I like drawing. Trish is an excellent motivator. And as, you know, the first time she handed me that piece of paper this week, I looked at the blank sheet and my garbage can lid of paint, and I didn't know where to begin. And then today it was easy. So thanks to her, you know, the fear of that white sheet somehow has gone. I just hope it stays gone. But it's fun, and I wasn't the only one with perfect attendance.
I've been looking at the line of laundry, you know, the half of the week that it's been up in the dining hall, and it's really sort of the spirit of Holden. So, next up we have another visual artist, Kristen Bauer, who's going to show us her work.
All right, so some of it is from previous classes I've taken before, and two of them are from this week. So this is from a class that Lori had taught, and this was in the Creekside So I don't know if you noticed, there's like a little window garden looking towards a creek. I did some basil and strawberries.
Oh, I like that. You're pretty.
And then from Judy's class, good Judy. I think that's her name, Judy. We just kind of had fun, you know, making up little pieces of art and just, I don't know, just letting myself go free and just have fun with it and not keep points. We had to choose a word for each picture we did, and so this one was my journey. And this one is peace. I like to say it's peace descending from heaven. And we have the rainbow going across the mountains.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Nice to see some of the continuity over different weeks at Holden. So next up we have Adrian Lartz, who's going to read.
Read, yes. A little nervous, but I'm in charge of the cookies, so you be nice to me. Family, sister, brother, children, nephew, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. You may wonder why I'm writing this from Holden Village in September 2012. It is memories I gleaned while in a writing session sitting in the Holden Valley surrounded by mountains. I felt I was surrounded by the Swiss Alps as I was of 13 years of age, but those are other memories. Our creative writing teacher said, write about your favorite soup or other food a person who cared for you made. While the topic seemed rather dry when I first heard what we were to write about. However, when I began writing, the memories I had forgotten flowed from my pencil. Mom made navy bean soup, usually on a weekend. It wasn't any ordinary bean soup you cook in an electric crock pot with a fancy lid and buttons labeled low, medium, high, and warm, and directions you had to read from the book each time about the automatic on and automatic off. No, the beans slowly simmered on top of the stove in a heavy pot all day long. The lid was heavier than the pot. Now, Mom didn't cook the beans with one of those little ham hocks you find today at Safeway that's sitting in the middle of white styrofoam and wrapped in plastic wrap. The ham Mom used looked like half a pig nestled with the simmering beans. So when you scooped your soup steaming into a bowl, the pieces of the ham were too large to fit in your soup spoon. The beans had cooked down into the consistency of Holden Village oatmeal, so thick you had to scrape the serving ladle with a spatula to get Mom's soup into your bowl. But this was a good thing because the homemade yeast rolls Dad made, soaked with melted butter, were used to scoop up the soup. I just love the smell of yeast rising, maybe more than when the rolls were actually baking. Cutting the rolls in half, if I had worn glasses, the steam would have fogged them. The butter hit the hot roll and immediately ran down the sides, so you either put the roll on top of the bean soup or on a separate plate. My navy bean soup never tastes as good as Mom's thick navy bean soup with chunks of ham eaten with Dad's homemade yeast rolls with butter dripping down the sides.
Adrian, and congratulations to your dad for making the rolls.
That was a tradition.
Next up, we have Larry Hoof, am I pronouncing your last name correctly? Who's also going to read literary work.
Well, we were on the same channel. The assignment was to talk about soup. and our favorite soup when we're roughly 7 years of age. Let me say that I didn't particularly care for my mother's soup, in part because it always came out of a Campbell's soup can, which is why I don't like Campbell's soup to this day. So I went a different direction. And this is supposed to be free writing, so it's not edited. It's just what's there, and I can never read my handwriting. My mother was not the world's greatest cook, but she knew that cooking was one of her tasks. My father worked for the railroad. It was hard physical labor, and he came home hungry. He was not a critical eater. He ate whatever my mom prepared. The food I enjoyed most was meatloaf. Meatloaf with mashed potatoes and gravy, which remains one of my favorites to this day. My tastes have changed, and I enjoy good, exotic foods from various cultures. I love nationality foods. I like to try new foods on the elaborate menus of classy restaurants. But I confess that to this very day, when I see meatloaf on a menu, I am tempted to order it, no matter what anyone thinks. My mother's kitchen was tiny. When Dad built our house, Mom asked for a small kitchen in which she could turn easily around and reach everything she wanted. Perhaps because the kitchen was small, her menus were relatively limited. Perhaps Dad had limited tastes and Mom only made the things she knew he liked. But certainly, meatloaf was one of them. Meatloaf with onions cooked up inside, meatloaf with breadcrumbs holding it together, and meatloaf with gravy. A meal fit for a railroad man who worked hard, and a meal fit for me.
Soup exercise. Generated all of these great stories.
I can almost taste that meatloaf.
So we have a lovely theme of Holden simplicity here. We have the paper frames, we have the laundry, we have the window box, we have the navy bean soup, we have the meatloaf. I don't know, Trish, if you're going to continue this theme, but Trish Pipkin is going to both show and read us work.
This is just an advertisement for the Upper 10 Mile Creek Trail.
Wow.
It's, you go down almost to 10 Mile Creek and then it zigzags up the hill. But it's not too long. It's not as far as Holden Lake. And you get up really high and you can almost see Lake Chelan. And there's not many people on it because there's nothing really at the end of it. You just turn around and come back. But this is a scene on the up the.
Will you put it over there with the light on it?
Just sort lean it against the wall.
All like right.
That would be nice.
Oh, nice.
We can sit and enjoy it.
Oh, yeah.
Is it acrylic paint or
oil? It's oil.
It's oil?
Uh-huh. If I caught you around earlier, I'd ask you to bring something to show, too. But anyway. I went to the Arctic one time because I love the sculpture from a place called Repulse Bay. But I'm changing the names of all the places because Inuit don't like anything negative said about them. And there were a few problems, and I don't want to whitewash everything. I'm just not that type of person. And so I just changed all the place names. And I will change my name as the first person narrator when I finish, or as I'm writing it. And this, if you're going into Canada and you're just going up to see some friends or a few days, there's never any problem. But if you're going up to stay a while, you have to have a letter of introduction to the village or place that you intend to stay a while, or some other documentation. When I reached the border of Canada and presented my letter of invitation to study the Inuit art in Resource Bay, Northwest Territories, which is also curiously known as Malad, the customs officer doubted it was genuine. The business letterheads from most of the northern villages weren't sent south to be printed or otherwise duplicated at that time, and the one on my letter was badly Xeroxed, somewhat like the fake Wyoming driver's license I'd used 30 years ago, which had stated I was 21 rather than 19. And he certainly wasn't going to call the number listed on that slightly smeared letterhead. If I were trying to illegally enter Canada to stay a while, I would, after all, probably have a friend at the number listed who would claim in a phony Inuit accented English that I most certainly had been invited to stay to study the stone carvings in his community. The man on duty in the pine forest smelling customs station in a prairie grove of trees northwest of War Road, Minnesota, elected to telephone Northwest Territories information and request the number of the village council office there. And after he finished making that call, he replaced the receiver, stood up behind his desk, and informed me there were no listings at all for a Resource Bay or a Malad either. I thought as I read the thin, pressed together lips, this man isn't going to let me into his country. Like Cassius, he had a lean and hungry look, and a significant portion of hair had molted from the top of his head. He seemed barely concealed as a lone wolf who'd been living on mice and campground garbage in his immaculately pressed uniform. At the same time, I could see where he was coming from. If I'd been in his shoes, I probably would have been suspicious too. But I thought I knew what the problem was. The village where I wanted to go was even smaller than Bike, Minnesota, and Bike's phone numbers were listed with those of larger and more affluent Crane Lake. And when I actually lived in Bike 2 years later, a significant number of us couldn't afford phones besides. I told the customs man about the Bike numbers listed with the Crane Lakes and asked if there was someone else he could contact. I'd inherited enough money to make this trip of my dreams. I'd read most of the works of Carl Jung and exploring the collective unconscious as a possible explanation for part of the curiousness of Arctic artwork, and spent time in the museum in a place called Border Lane. It's spelled almost like borderline, but it's pronounced so it rhymes with Coeur d'Alene. And I'd looked particularly at the sculpture I liked best, created at my journey's destination. What about the portable typewriter, ream of paper, tape recorder, blank tapes, and microphone in my luggage? Had they all been gathered in vain? The customs officer, in sizing me up, saw a look of determination, and I knew that back in those days of payphones, I'd stop at the first one I came to and make a few calls myself if he declined to do it right now, and that I wasn't about to turn around and go back home. So he telephoned about a boss in Ottawa who asked him to read the letter aloud, which he proceeded to do in what he believed was his most seriously official voice. He sounded to me like a newscaster covering the funeral of John F. Kennedy. and unfortunately he hadn't bothered to read the letter first. He got through the obligatory polite phrases all right, but he realized he was in trouble even before he finished the last sentence without having altered his delivery style any. The line was, "And all of us here are dying to try the bannock you said you learned how to make in Borderland." And in the one small room of the customs house near the western Minnesota northern border, and even across the desk from the one man on duty, I could hear the laughter of the superior in eastern Canada, who thought my having listed one qualification for my studying the art in the Arctic village as an ability to bake good bannock was seriously funny. He obviously was pretty sure a letter which referred to my being able to make good bannock was genuine as well. I couldn't hear as well what he said to the customs officer as I could his last letter, but that man's hand as he held the letter began to shake, and he dropped the letter, and I got into Canada pretty fast after that.
Next up, we have Otto Brask, who also had perfect attendance in the writing workshop. And you're going to tell us, read us a story or show us art.
I will show my masterpiece first. Where the river flows, life abounds. I took a walk on the nature walk from about the covered bridge and down through the river, and there I was inspired by the sun shining from the east. It was early this morning, and the water actually was blue, and I took a picture with my camera, and I brought that to Trish's painting class this afternoon, and I opened up my camera and said, I think I can sketch that. So I laid out my style and the bridge and the river. That's my artwork. Thank you. I will do a little writing, a reading also afterwards.
After? Okay. Great. Next up is Chris Schultz. What are you going to share with us?
Some writing.
Great, some writing. Fabulous.
Actually, just a short story. And I don't have half of it, so I'll have to.
It's Father's Day.
What's that?
Father's Day.
It's our Father's Day.
Your story will be Father's Day.
No, you don't want to hear the Father's Day. They have an even worse reputation than the Mother's Day. This was, I don't even remember what the assignment was, something I wrote last year. Trish said to ask me to read it again. But I only have half of it because I sent it to my dad about a month before he died. And cut out the beginning because he knew it all. So I'll just give a brief introduction to it. This is my dad was a Lutheran pastor, missionary to Madagascar, and that's where I grew up. And when I was living out there, I went to a boarding school, and all the kids that I went to school with were Lutheran missionary kids, and so pretty much. Growing up, all I knew were Lutherans, that was just the way it was. And then I picked up. So when we moved back to the States, I found the Lutheran church to be very boring. And most of the people who I knew who were excited and outspoken about their faith were not Lutheran. I was ready to leave the Lutheran church for anything, as long as it wasn't Lutheran. But my mom and dad, through multiple conversations, kept trying to talk me out of this and encourage me to stay in the Lutheran church. Finally, out of frustration, I blurted out to my dad, "You can't honestly believe that the Lutheran church is the best, most theologically correct church in the world." A smile came over his face as he said, "Yes, I do. If I didn't believe this, I wouldn't be a Lutheran pastor." His simple, non-defensive confession is a big reason that 30 years later, I am still a Lutheran Christian.
Great. Thanks for that story, Chris. And now Kathleen Bernie's going to tell us another story.
All week I threatened my yoga students that we would do something here, and nobody really jumped on the bandwagon. Actually, it was Trisha's class that allowed me time to write about this story and think about it, and it's still in process, and I have profound perfectionist tendencies, so I couldn't read you any small part of it. I'm just telling you the story. back in 1993, I was running Sea Kayak Tours, operating Sea Kayak Tours, and I had a friend who was a Lummi elder. The Lummi Nation are people who live near Bellingham, Washington. And there was an event happening in central British Columbia. It was called Kwatawas, which was the native language word for gathering from that area. And Pauline came to me and requested a donation to enable her to take her dance troupe, the Setting Sun Dancers, up to Kwatawas, which involved a ferry over to Vancouver Island, driving the length of Vancouver Island, and then taking another ferry to the coast, central coast of BC. I think she was about in her early 60s at this time. And I thought that sounded exciting and I wanted to go. But I just made a donation and wished her well, because I had a kayak trip to do. So, oddly enough, pretty soon somebody called and canceled, and they couldn't come on the kayak trip, and then there weren't quite so many people on the kayak trip, and there was this desire. So long after they had driven this trip and arrived up there, I got on a plane out of the Vancouver airport and flew in this, I think it was a 12 or 14 passenger plane up the coast of BC, which was utterly spectacular. So I was off on a lark and ready to have a great time and be entertained, and I thought maybe even the airplane ride was the highlight. And when I landed and got there, I found that Pauline had forgotten the boys' paddle shirts. And paddle shirts are they're normally made of doe skin, and they have hundreds of little cedar paddles beaded on, so when you dance, they make noise. They were laying at home on the bed in Bellingham, and we were all up in Bella Bella, BC, which is the very central coast of British Columbia. What I ended up learning about was hospitality and identity as a people, because the hereditary chief's son had stayed up all night and carved her hundreds of cedar paddles. Mm. And someone must have given her material to make the shirts. And as soon as I got to the village, we sat for a day and a half and beaded cedar paddles onto the shirts. Mm. And I could have gone and wandered around the village as a stranger, but I just wanted to stay with the folks I knew, and that's what we did. So we did have a little bit of entertainment because the Haida, the people from Queen Charlotte's, paddled in. And the ceremony is that you come and you sing your song and you are in full regalia. The Haida canoes have a 7-foot prow because they're ocean-going canoes. They're up to 20 people in them. and they are pounding their canoe paddles on the bottom of the boat and singing. And then the group on the beach sings a song in return and welcome. And their song says who they are and where they've come from. And the return song says welcome. You're welcome here for what you need. And I'm standing there next to Pauline, and there's a single kayaker out there in the background. And Pauline says, well, he looks really puny, doesn't he? And I started to get a little kayaker myth there, you know. And I looked at it and I thought, yeah, one person in a single little kayak compared to these people in this beautiful ocean-going canoe with their identity as a people made him look pretty puny. So then it was time to kind of check in officially. So I went and talked to people, and for being just somebody who showed up without any affiliation, I was supposed to pay $60 a day or something. And I went and told Pauline, and she said, we'll give you regalia so you can parade in with us and tell them you're with us, and then you won't have to pay. Sounds like a good deal. So they gave me some regalia. And I walk into this gymnasium, and there are hundreds of Native people all the way from Washington to Alaska. And I am feeling like a wannabe, a really big time wannabe. And we parade in and sit down, and the man I sit next to leans over and says, I'm sitting next to an Indian princess. Which made everything just worse in my mind. And then what happens is that we dance in front of these people. And of course, I've never danced these dances, and I say, what are we going to do? They say, follow us. So it was just an absolutely amazing experience where I wasn't sitting and being entertained. I was welcomed into a world that was amazing values that I'd never experienced before. Oh, there was one last story, and that is that the very most important moment came, and during all these things there was gift giving, there were all sorts of things and important speeches, and the whole time kids are running around and everybody's talking and there's all sorts of stuff happening. But the very most important moment, when they made everyone be quiet and absolutely still, I thought, well, in my mind I thought there's going to be some important chief, he's probably going to be male, about 50 or 60 years old. I didn't even know I had these thoughts in my head. The person who came up was a little old, mid-80s, maybe 90s lady. She had a polyester suit on, and she had a perm. And she spoke the Native language, and she addressed the whole crowd, and that's when we sat and listened quietly. The entire weekend, that was the only time that happened. So I encountered a world of different values than the one I've lived in, and it was an amazing experience.
Thank you, Kathleen, for that story about the power of language. Otto, you can come read us a story.
Am I the last one?
Anyone else inspired to share?
I'll dress up for this occasion. It must be because I'm the oldest in the crowd that I'm last. I wrote a piece I called Nuts in My Pocket. In the pocket of my windbreaker jacket, I carry this nut. It's a brown nut, oblong, smooth, just a regular pecan nut. I fondle it often in my pocket. It feels good to the touch. It comforts me, and it reminds me about my stay at home.
About 10 years ago in this place, at Vespers in Koinonia, Pastor Maya passed around a bowl of nuts, asking each of us to take a couple, to have something tangible in our hands, while she told us about God's all-encompassing love and forgiveness beyond our understanding. We have this treasure in clay jars, a gift that no one can take away from us, not because we are so clever or deserving or so protective of it, but because God, in His grace, has chosen to give it to us freely. I carried those nuts in my pocket for several years. Alas, one dropped out of the pocket on the floor while I was on a bus ride. It got crushed, trampled underfoot by the crowd. It was a sad event. Such may also happen to our physical treasure or our best laid plans for how we wish to conduct our lives. We too may stumble and fall. We may get crushed or dismayed by unemployment, by sickness, or by death of a loved one. I still carry this nut in my pocket. I fondle it often. It reminds me of the gift of Holden, of hospitality, of hilarity. It reminds me of God's love for me even when I make a fool of myself. It keeps on telling me, don't take yourself too seriously. End of speech.
Okay, true confession. I'm interested in talking about this because Trish said, my wife said, go down there. So,
John must be one of the younger ones here.
I was so pleased this week that Trish was here. The students got a chance to go down, and I got a chance to go down also, and just do those sketches. So, from the the Shelley 2 basement, looking out the. Of course, the scene everyone knows. And just when I was doing it, I wanted to have to include the schoolhouse, and so I made a fiction of the middle part and brought the mountains down and the house up. And then and afterwards, got the black ink on it, which is fun.
Nice work.
And then I get to do it. It says like 45 minutes. Like, oh, how great! You can do it. And then the next day, I did it again, and it's different light. The light was really shining on it, and I got to experiment with the colors on it, and it was fun. And then the next day, the light was different again. The smoke came in, and it was all muted. And so did the muted, and then I got back today from our hike, and I used the pen. I said, well, it was so muted. I didn't want to use the pen, but it just looks so much better when you use the pen. So I was using the pen, and this one here, I did the sketch, and I had 15 minutes to paint it. So I painted it in 15 minutes. Actually, 18 minutes. I was 5 minutes late for my meeting. And so it was very sketchy. And so today, I was like, oh, I don't want to do my will. And then I started, I was very tired after the hike. No one else was, but I was tired. And it became a meditative thing, going around the sort of outlines, the different blotches of color. And it doesn't look as great to me now as it did earlier, but it was very satisfying at the time. And I was just following the impulse, and following the instinct, and following the way the water had run into the paper, and it felt very organic, and it felt like the right thing to be doing at the time, and it was a good feeling, and I found myself like seeing, oh, there's a chicken running, and oh, that looks like the map of New England or something, and this is like, and it looks kind of like a tree in the mountains, and it was just a wonderful, satisfying experience, and I was trying to talk about how doing a watercolor painting for me is like fishing, because if you stand, it's like by yourself. Oh, look at that stream, that's so beautiful. But if you're fishing, you're like, oh, he's fishing, it's so cool. If you sit at the mountain, say, look at that mountain, how is the light hitting that thing? Oh, is that rock, those trees? What? you look kind of stupid, but you're like, oh, I'm doing a watercolor. You're really doing it. So it's a great excuse to like space out. It's so cool. And so I'm so grateful that Trisha's here. And I'm so grateful for this. I used to do little postcard watercolors when I go out somewhere. And that's where I realized I'm so glad I can do this because I really am enjoying looking at that waterfall or whatever it is. But if I were just, you know, sitting there, it would be really, really dumb. And it's satisfying to have something that comes off kind of, you know, like something. And, yeah. So, again, this is also sort of fictional, but I think it's good to both bring your memory. And I was wondering, too, you know, am I doing things here that are like a psychological projection of some underlying part of me? I'm sure I am. So, trees are blotchy and
it's sort of a lie.
Anyway, thank you, Trish.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you all. Okay.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Otto. Thank you all for being here. Thank you, those of you that shared your work. Give yourselves another hand.